no generation. He moves eternally through the world, so that any dancer in any age may recognize him. Picasso would be incomprehensible to Rembrandt, but Nijinsky would understand Michael Jackson.
"Don't stop now, girls! Get up!"
cried Tracy's mother, and for a moment we paused to rest against her sofa.
"Don't stop till you get enough! Get moving!"
How long that song seemed. Longer than life. I felt it would never end, that we were caught in a time loop and would have to dance in this demonic way forever, like poor Moira Shearer in the red shoes. Time rushes by, love rushes by, life rushes by, but the red shoes dance on. But then it was over.
"Oh, that was fucking priceless,"
sighed Tracy's mother, forgetting herself, and we bowed and curtsied and ran to Tracy's room.
"She loves it when she sees him on TV," confided Tracy once we were alone. "It makes their love stronger. She sees him and she knows he still loves her."
"Which one was he?" I asked.
"Second row at the end, on the right,"
replied Tracy, without missing a beat. I did not try, it wasn't possible, to integrate these facts about Tracy's father with the very few occasions I actually saw him, the first of which was the most terrible. It was in early November, not long after we had watched Thriller. We were all three in the kitchen, trying to make jacket potatoes stuffed with cheese and bacon. We were going to wrap them in foil and take them with us to Roundwood Park, where we'd watch the fireworks. The kitchens in the flats on Tracy's estate were even smaller than the kitchens in ours. When you opened the oven door, it almost scraped the wall opposite. To have three people in there at the same time, one person, in this case Tracy, had to sit on the counter. It was her job to scrape the potato out of its jacket, and then my job, standing next to her, to mix the potato with grated cheese and bacon bits snipped with a pair of scissors, and then her mother put it all back in the jacket and returned it to the oven for browning. Despite my mother's constant implication that Tracy's mother was slovenly, a magnet for chaos, I found her kitchen both cleaner and more orderly than ours. The food was never healthy, and yet it was prepared with seriousness and care, whereas my mother, who aspired to healthy eating, could not spend 15 minutes in a kitchen without being reduced to a sort of self-pitying mania, and quite often the whole misguided experiment to make vegetarian lasagna to do something with okra became so torturous for everybody that she would manufacture a row and storm off shouting. We would end up eating Finder's crispy pancakes again. Round Tracy's, things were simpler. You began with the clear intention of making Finder's crispy pancakes or pizza from Frozen or sausages and chips, and it was all delicious and no one shouted about it. These potatoes were a special treat, a fireworks night tradition. Outside it was dark, though only 5 in the afternoon, and all over the estate you could smell gunpowder. Each flat had its private arsenal, and the random bangs and small, localized conflagrations had begun 2 weeks before, as soon as the sweet shop started selling fireworks. No one waited for official events. Cats were the most frequent victims of this general pyromania, but every now and then some kid went off to casualty. Because of all the banging and how used we were to bangs, at first the sound of someone beating on Tracy's front door didn't register. But then we heard somebody half yelling and half whispering, and we recognized panic and caution fighting each other. It was a man's voice. He was saying,
"Let me in! Let me in! You there? Open up, woman!"
Tracy and I stared at her mother, who stood staring back at us, holding a tray of perfectly stuffed cheesy potatoes in her hand. Without looking at what she was doing, she tried to lower the tray onto the counter, misjudged, dropped it.
"Louis?"
she said. She grabbed us both, pulled Tracy off the counter. We stepped in potato. She dragged us down the hall and pushed us into Tracy's room. We were not to move a muscle. She closed the door and left us alone. Tracy went straight to her bed, got in it, and began playing Pac-Man. She wouldn't look at me. It was clear I couldn't ask her anything, not even if Louis was the name of her father. I stood where her mother had left me and waited. I had never heard such a commotion in Tracy's house. Whoever Louis was, he had now been let in, or forced his way in, and fuck was every other word. And there were great, crashing thuds as he turned the furniture over, and a terrible feminine wailing. It sounded like a screaming fox. I stood by the door, looking at Tracy, who was still tucked up in her Barbie bed, but she did not seem to hear what I heard, or even to remember that I was there. She never looked up from her Pac-Man. 10 minutes later, it was over. We heard the front door slam shut. Tracy stayed in her bed, and I stood where I had been planted, unable to make any move. After a while, there was a light knock on the door, and Tracy's mother came in, pink with crying, holding a tray of Angel Delight, the same pink as her face. We sat and ate in silence, and later went to the fireworks. 9. There was a kind of carelessness among the mothers we knew, or it looked like carelessness to outsiders, but we knew it by another name. To the teachers at the school, it probably looked as if they didn't care enough even to turn up for parents' evening, where, at desk after desk, the teachers sat, staring into space, waiting patiently for these mothers who never came. And I can see that our mothers must have seemed a little careless when, informed by a teacher of some misbehavior in the playground, they would, instead of reprimanding the child, begin shouting at the teacher. But we understood our mothers a little better. We knew that they, in their own time, had feared school, just as we did now, feared the arbitrary rules and felt shamed by them, by the new uniforms they couldn't afford, the baffling obsession with quiet, the incessant correcting of their original patois or cockney, the sense that they could never do anything right anyway, a deep anxiety about being told off for who they were, for what they had or hadn't done, and now for the deeds of their children. This fear never really left our mothers, many of whom had become our mothers when they were not much more than children themselves. And so parents' evening was, in their minds, not so distant from detention. It remained a place where they might be shamed. The difference was now they were grown and could not be forced to attend. I say our mothers, but of course mine was different. She had the anger, but not the shame. She went to parents' evening, always. That year, it was for some reason held on Valentine's Day. The hall was limply decorated with pink paper hearts stapled to the walls, and each desk sported a wilting rose of crinkled tissue paper atop a green pipe cleaner. I trailed behind her as she made her way round the room, hectoring teachers, ignoring all attempts on their part to discuss my progress, instead giving a series of impromptu lectures about the incompetence of the school administration, the blindness and the stupidity of the local council, the desperate need for teachers of colour, which I think was the first time I heard the new euphemism, of colour. Those poor teachers clutched the sides of their desks for dear life. At one point, to emphasise a statement, she thumped a fist on a desk, sending the tissue rose and many pencils scattering to the floor. These children deserve more. Not me in particular. These children. How I remember her doing that, and how wonderful she looked, like a queen. I was proud to be her child, the daughter of the only mother in the neighbourhood, free of shame. We swept out of the hall together, my mother triumphant, me in a state of awe. Neither of us any the wiser as to how I was doing at school. I do remember one occasion of shame. A few days before Christmas, a late afternoon on a Saturday after dance class, after Lambert's, and I was watching a Fred and Ginger routine, Pick Yourself Up, at my flat, with Tracy over and over. Tracy had an ambition to one day recreate the whole routine herself. This seems to me now like looking at the Sistine Chapel and hoping to recreate it on your bedroom ceiling. Though she only ever practiced the male part, it never occurred to either of us to learn Ginger's part in anything. Tracy was standing in the doorway to the living room, tap dancing. There was no carpet over there. And I was kneeling by the VHS, rewinding and pausing as necessary. My mother was in the kitchen on a high stool, studying. My father, and this was unusual, had gone out, with no explanation, just out, at about 4 o'clock, with no stated purpose and no errand to run that I knew of. At a certain point, I ventured into the kitchen to get 2 beakers of Ribena. Instead of seeing my mother bent over her books, earplugs in, oblivious to me, I found her gazing out of the window, her face wet with tears. When she saw me, she jumped a little in her skin, as if I were a ghost. "They're here," she said, almost to herself. I looked over to where she was looking, and saw my father crossing the estate with 2 young white people trailing behind him, a boy of about 20 and a girl who looked to be 15 or 16. "Who's here?" "Some people your father wants you to meet." And the shame that she felt, I think, was the shame of no control. She could not dominate this situation, nor protect me from it, as, for once, it had nothing much to do with her. She hurried instead to the living room and told Tracy to leave, but Tracy was deliberately slow collecting up her things. She wanted to get a good look at them. They were a sight. Seen up close, the boy had shaggy blonde hair and a beard. He wore dirty, ugly, old-looking clothes. His jeans were patched, and he had lots of rock band badges pinned to his frayed canvas rucksack. He seemed to be shamelessly advertising his poverty. The girl was equally peculiar, but neater, truly white as snow, as in a fairy tale, with a severe black bob cut straight across her forehead and diagonally high at her ears. She was dressed all in black, with a big black pair of Dr. Martens on her feet, and she was petite, with delicate features, excepting a large, indecent bosom, which she seemed to be trying to obscure with all this black. Tracy and I stood staring at them.
"Time you went home," said my father to Tracy.
And watching her go, I realized how much my ally she was, despite everything. For without her, at that moment, I felt totally undefended. The white teenagers sloped into our small living room. My father asked them to sit, but only the girl did. I was alarmed to see my mother, whom ordinarily I knew to be a completely non-neurotic person, dithering anxiously, stumbling over her words. The boy, his name was John, would not sit down. When my mother tried to encourage him to sit down, he wouldn't look at or reply to her. And then my father said something uncharacteristically sharp, and we all watched as John marched back out of the flat. I ran to the balcony and saw him down there on the communal grass, not going anywhere. He had to wait for the girl, stamping around in a small circle, crunching the hoarfrost underfoot. This left the girl. Her name was Emma. When I came back in, my mother told me to sit next to her.
"This is your sister," said my father, and went to make a cup of tea.
My mother stood by the Christmas tree, pretending to do something useful with the lights. The girl turned to me, and we stared frankly at each other. As far as I could see, we had no features in common at all. The whole thing was ridiculous, and I could see that this Emma person thought exactly the same of me. Apart from the comically obvious fact that I was black and she was white, I was big-boned and she was narrow. I was tall for my age, and she was short for hers. My eyes were big and brown, and hers were narrow and green. But then, at the same moment, I felt we both saw it. The downturned mouth, the sad eyes. I don't remember thinking logically. I didn't ask myself, for example, who the mother of this Emma was, or how and when she could possibly have known my father. My head wouldn't go that far round. I only thought, he made one like me and one like her. How can 2 such different creatures emerge from the same source? My father came back into the room with a tray of tea.
"Well, this is all a bit of a surprise, isn't it?"
he said, handing Emma a mug.
"For all of us. It's a long time since I've seen... But you see, your mum suddenly decided. Well, she's a woman of sudden whims, isn't she?"
My sister looked blankly at my father, and he at once gave up whatever he was trying to say and downgraded to small talk.
Now, I'm told Emma does a bit of ballet. That's something you two have in common. At the Royal Ballet for a little while, full scholarship, but she had to stop.
Dancing on stage, did he mean? In Covent Garden? As a principal? Or in the corps, as Tracy called it? But no, scholarship sounded like a school matter. Was there, then, a Royal Ballet School? But if such a place existed, why hadn't I been sent to it? And if this Emma had been sent there, who paid for it? Why did she have to stop? Because her chest was so large? Or did a bullet go right up her thigh?
Maybe you'll dance together one day,
said my mother into the silence, which was the kind of maternal inanity in which she very rarely indulged. Emma looked up at my mother fearfully. It was the first time she had dared look at her directly, and whatever she saw there had the power to freshly horrify. She burst into tears. My mother left the room. My father said to me, "Go out for a bit. Go on. Put your coat on." I slipped off the sofa, grabbed my duffel coat off the hook, and let myself out. I went down the walkway, trying to put what little I knew of my father's past together with this new reality. He was from Whitechapel, a large East End family, not as big as my mother's, but not far off, and his father had been a minor criminal of some kind, in and out of jail, and this, my mother once explained to me, was why my father put so much effort into my childhood, cooking, taking me to school and a dance class, packing my lunches and so on, all unusual activities for a father at the time. I was compensation, retribution, for his own childhood. I knew, too, that he had himself been, at one point, no good. Once we were watching TV, and something about the Cray twins came on, and my father said casually,
"Oh, well, everybody knew them. You couldn't help knowing them at that time."
His many siblings were no good. The East End in general was no good. And this all helped consolidate my idea of our own corner of London as a little, clear-aired peak above a general quagmire into which you might be dragged back into real poverty and crime from several directions. But no one had ever mentioned a son or a daughter. I took the stairs down to the communal area and stood resting against a concrete pillar, watching my brother kick up little scraps of half-frozen turf. With his long hair and beard and that long face, he looked like adult Jesus to me, whom I knew solely from a cross on the wall at Miss Isabel's dance class. Unlike my reaction to the girl, simply that some kind of fraud was underway, looking at the boy, I found I could not deny his essential rightness. It was right that he should be my father's son. Anyone looking at him would see the sense of it. What didn't make sense was me. Something coldly objective took me over, that same instinct that allowed me to separate my voice from my throat as an object of consideration, of study, came to me now. And I looked at this boy and thought, yes, he is right, and I am wrong. Isn't it interesting? I could have, I suppose, thought of myself as the true child and the boy as the counterfeit, but I didn't do that. He turned round and spotted me. Something in his face told me I was being pitied, and I was moved when, with effortful kindness, he began a game of hide-and-seek around the concrete pillars. Every time his shaggy blonde head popped out from behind a block, I had that out-of-body sensation. Here is my father's son, looking just like my father's son. Isn't that interesting? As we played, we heard raised voices from upstairs. I tried to ignore them, but my new playmate stopped running and stood under the balcony and listened. At a certain point, the anger flashed back into his eyes, and he said to me, "Let me tell you something. He don't care about no one. He's not what he seems. He's fucked up in the head, marrying that bloody Spade." And then the girl came running down the stairs. No one ran after her. Not my father or my mother. She was still crying, and she came to the boy and they hugged and, still hugging, walked across the grass and out of the estate. Snow was lightly falling. I watched them go. I didn't see them again until my father died, and they were never spoken of during my childhood. For a long time, I thought the whole thing was a hallucination, or perhaps something I'd lifted from a bad film. When Tracy asked me about it, I told her the truth, although with some elaboration. I claimed that a building we walked past daily on Wilsdon Lane, the one with the shabby blue awning, was the Royal Ballet School, and that my cruel white posh sister went there and was very successful but refused even to wave to me from the window. Can you believe it? As she listened, I witnessed a great struggle in her face to believe it, mostly expressed by her nostrils. Of course, Tracy very likely had been inside that building herself and would have known perfectly well what it really was, a down-at-heel event space where a lot of cheap local weddings were held and sometimes the bingo. A few weeks later, as I was sitting in the back of my mother's ridiculous car, a tiny white, ostentatiously French 2CV with a CND sticker placed next to the tax disc, I spotted a hard-faced bride, half-swallowed by tulle and ringlets, standing outside my royal ballet, smoking a fag, but I did not let this vision penetrate my fantasy. By then I had come to share my friend's insusceptibility to reality. And now, as if we were both trying to get on a seesaw at the same time, neither of us pressed too hard, and a delicate equilibrium was allowed to persist. I could have my evil ballerina if she could have her backing dancer. Maybe I never got out of this habit of elaboration. 20 years later, over a difficult lunch, I revisited the story of my ghostly siblings with my mother, who sighed, lit a cigarette, and said, "Trust you to add snow." 10. Long before it became a career, my mother had a political mind. It was in her nature to think of people collectively. Even as a child, I noticed it, and felt instinctively that there was something chilly and unfeeling in her ability to analyze so precisely the people she lived among, her friends, her community, her own family. We were all, at one and the same time, people she knew and loved, but also objects of study, living embodiments of all she seemed to be learning up at Middlesex Poly. She held herself apart, always. She never submitted, for example, to the neighborhood cult of sharpness, the passion for shiny shell suits and sparkling fake gems, for whole days spent in the hair salon, children in 50-quid trainers, settees paid for over several years on hire purchase, although neither would she ever entirely condemn it. "People are not poor because they've made bad choices," my mother liked to say. "They make bad choices because they're poor." But though she was serene and anthropological about these matters in her college essays, or while lecturing me and my father across the dinner table, I knew in her real life she was often exasperated. She didn't pick me up from school anymore. My father did that now, because the scene there aggravated her too much. In particular, the way each afternoon time collapsed and all those mothers became kids again. Kids who had come to collect their kids. And all of these kids together turned from school with relief, free finally to speak with each other in their own way, and to laugh and joke and eat ice cream from the waiting ice cream van, and to make what they considered to be a natural amount of noise. My mother didn't fit into all of that any longer. She still cared for the group, intellectually, politically, but she was no longer one of them. Every now and then she did get caught up in it, usually by some error of timing, and found herself trapped in a conversation with a mother, often Tracy's, on Wilsdon Lane. On these occasions she could turn callous, making a point of mentioning each new academic achievement of mine, or inventing some, although she knew that all Tracy's mother could offer in return was more of Miss Isabel's praise, which was, to my mother, an entirely worthless commodity. My mother was proud of trying harder than Tracy's mother, than all the mothers, of having got me into a half-decent state school instead of one of the several terrible ones. She was in a competition of caring, and yet her fellow contestants, like Tracy's mother, were so ill-equipped when placed beside her that it was a fatally lopsided battle. I often wondered, is it some kind of a trade-off? To do others have to lose so we can win? One morning in early spring, my father and I ran into Tracy under our block by the garages. She seemed agitated, and though she said she was only cutting through our estate on the way to her own, I felt certain she'd been waiting for me. She looked cold. I wondered whether she'd been to school at all. I knew she sometimes bunked off with the approval of her mother. My mother had been shocked to see them both, one school day afternoon, coming out of What She Wants on the high road, laughing, carrying a load of shopping bags. I watched my father greet Tracy warmly. Unlike my mother, he had no anxiety in connection with her. He found her single-minded dedication to her dancing sweet, and also, I think, admirable. It appealed to his work ethic, and it was very clear that Tracy adored my father, was even a little in love with him. She was so painfully grateful for the way he talked to her like a father, although sometimes he went too far in this direction, not understanding that what came after borrowing a father for a few minutes was the pain of having to give him back.
"Exams coming up, aren't they?" he asked her now. "And how's all that going?"
Tracy stuck her nose proudly in the air.
"I'm doing all six categories."
"Course you are."
"For modern, though, I ain't doing it by myself. I'm pairing. Ballet's my strongest, then tap, then modern, then song and dance. I'm going for 3 golds at least, but if it was 2 golds and 4 silvers, I'd be well happy with that."
"And so you should be."
She puts her little hands on her hips.
"You coming to watch us then, or what?"
"Oh, I'll be there, with bells on, cheering my girls on."
Tracy loved to boast to my father. She unfurled in his presence, sometimes even blushed, and the monosyllabic no and yes answers she tended to give to all other adults, including my mother, disappeared, to be replaced by this running babble, as if she thought that any pause in the flow might run the risk of losing my father's attention altogether.
"Got some news,"
she said casually, turning to me, and now I understood why we'd run into her.
"My mum's sorted it."
"Sorted what?" I asked.
"I'm leaving my school," she said. "I'm coming to yours."
Later, at home, I told my mother this news, and she too was surprised, and I suspected a little displeased, at this proof of Tracy's mother's exertion on her daughter's behalf more than anything else. She kissed her teeth. I really didn't think she had it in her. 11. It took Tracy moving to my classroom for me to understand what my classroom really was. I had thought it was a room full of children. In fact, it was a social experiment. The dinner lady's daughter shared a desk with the son of an art critic. A boy whose father was presently in prison shared a desk with the son of a policeman. The child of the postal officer shared a desk with the child of one of Michael Jackson's backing dancers. One of Tracy's first acts as my new deskmate was to articulate these subtle differences by way of a simple, compelling analogy. Cabbage Patch Kids versus Garbage Pail Kids. Each child was categorized as one or the other, and she made it clear that any friendship I had formed before her arrival was now, in as far as it may have attempted to cross this divide, null and void, worthless. For the truth was, it had never truly existed in the first place. There could be no real friendship between Cabbage Patch and Garbage Pail. Not right now, not in England. She emptied our desk of my beloved Cabbage Patch Kid card collection and replaced them with her Garbage Pail Kid cards, which, like almost everything Tracy did in school, at once became the new craze. Even children who were, in Tracy's eyes, cabbage patch types themselves, began to collect the Garbage Pail Kids. Even Lily Bingham collected them, and we all competed with each other to own the most repulsive cards. The Garbage Pail Kid with snot streaming down his face, or the one pictured on the toilet. Her other striking innovation was her refusal to sit down. She would only stand at her desk, bending forward to work. Our teacher, a kind and energetic man called Mr. Sherman, battled her for a week, but Tracy's will, like my mother's, was made of iron, and in the end she was allowed to stand as she pleased. I don't think Tracy had any special passion for standing up. It was a point of principle. The principle could have been anything, really, but the point was she would win it. It was clear that Mr. Sherman, having lost this argument, felt he must come down hard in some other area. And one morning, as we were all excitedly swapping garbage pail kids instead of listening to whatever he was saying, he suddenly went completely out of his mind, screaming like a lunatic, going from desk to desk, seizing the cards, sometimes from inside the desk and sometimes from our hands, until he had a huge pile of them on his desk, which he then shuffled into a tower laid on its side and brushed into a drawer, locking it ostentatiously with a little key. Tracy said nothing, but her piggy nose flared, and I thought, oh dear, doesn't Mr. Sherman realize she'll never forgive him? The same afternoon, after school, we walked home together. She wouldn't talk to me, she was still in her fury. But when I tried to turn into my estate, she grabbed my wrist and led me across the road to hers. All the way up in the lift, we were silent. It seemed to me something momentous was about to happen. I could feel her rage like an aura around her. It almost vibrated. When we got to her front door, I saw that the knocker, a brass lion of Judah with its mouth open, bought on the high road from one of the stalls that sold Africana, had been damaged and now hung by a single nail. And I wondered if her father had been round again. I followed Tracy to her room. Once the door was closed, she turned on me, glaring, as if I myself were Mr. Sherman, asking me sharply what I wanted to do now that we were here. I had no idea. Never before had I been canvassed for ideas of what to do. She was the one with all the ideas. There had never been any planning by me before today. Well, what's the point of coming round if you don't fucking know? She flopped down onto her bed, picked up Pac-Man, and started playing. I felt my face getting hot. I meekly suggested practicing our triple time steps, but this made Tracy groan. Don't need to. I'm onto wings. But I can't do wings yet. Look, she said, without raising her eyes from her screen. You can't get silver without doing wings. Forget about gold. So what's your dad gonna come and watch you fuck it all up for? My point is there. I looked at my stupid feet that couldn't do wings. I sat down and began quietly to cry. This changed nothing, and after a minute I found myself pitiful and stopped. I decided to busy myself organizing Barbie's wardrobe. All her clothes had been stuffed into Ken's open-top automobile. It was my plan to extract them, flatten them, hang them on their little hangers, and place them back in the wardrobe, the kind of game I was never permitted to play at home due to its echoes of domestic oppression. Halfway through this painstaking procedure, Tracy's heart mysteriously softened towards me. She slipped from the bed and joined me cross-legged on the floor. Together, we got that tiny white woman's life in order. 12. We had a favorite video. It was labeled Saturday Cartoons and Top Hat, and moved weekly from my flat to Tracy's and back, played so often that tracking now ate the frame, from above and below. Because of this, we couldn't risk forward winding while playing. It made the tracking worse. So we forward wound blind, guessing at duration by assessing the width of the black tape as it flew from one reel to another. Tracy was an expert forward winder. She seemed to know in her body exactly when we'd gone past the irrelevant cartoons and when to press stop to reach, for example, the song Cheek to Cheek. It strikes me now that if I want to watch this same clip, as I did a few minutes ago, just before writing this, it's no effort at all. It's the work of a moment. I type my request in the box, and it's there. Back then, there was a craft to it. We were the first generation to have, in our own homes, the means to re- and forward-wind reality. Even very small children could press their fingers against those clunky buttons and see what has been, become, what is, or what will be. When Tracy was about this process, she was absolutely concentrated. She would not press play until she had Fred and Ginger exactly where she wanted them. On the balcony, among the bougainvillea and the Doric columns. At which point she began to read the dance. As I never could, she saw everything. The stray ostrich feathers hitting the floor, the weak muscles in Ginger's back, the way Fred had to jerk her up from any supine position, spoiling the flow, ruining the line. She noticed the most important thing of all, which is the dance lesson within the performance. With Fred and Ginger, you can always see the dance lesson. In a sense, the dance lesson is the performance. He's not looking at her with love, not even fake movie love. He's looking at her as Miss Isabel looked at us. Don't forget X. Please keep in mind Y. Arm up now, leg down, spin, dip, bow. Look at her, Tracy said, smiling oddly, pressing a finger to Ginger's face on the screen. She looks fucking scared. It was during one of these viewings that I learnt something new and important about Louis. On this occasion, the flat was empty, and as it annoyed Tracy's mother when we watched the same clip multiple times, that afternoon, we indulged ourselves. The moment Fred came to a rest and leant against the balustrade, Tracy shuffled forward on all fours and pressed the button down again, and off we went, back to what once was. We must have watched the same 5-minute clip a dozen times, until suddenly it was enough. Tracy got up and told me to follow. It was dark outside. I wondered when her mother would be home. We walked past the kitchen to the bathroom. It was exactly the same as my bathroom. Same cork floor, same avocado bathroom set. She got down on her knees and pushed the side panel of the bath. It fell in easily. Sitting in a Clark's shoebox just by the pipes was a small gun. Tracy picked up the box and showed it to me. She told me it was her father's, that he had left it here, and when Michael came to Wembley at Christmas, Louis would be his security man as well as one of his dancers. It had to be that way to confuse people. It was all top secret. You tell anyone, she told me, and you are dead. She put the panel back and went to the kitchen to start making her tea. I headed home. I remember feeling intensely envious of the glamour of Tracy's family life compared to my own, its secretive and explosive nature. And I walked towards my own flat, trying to think of some equivalent revelation I could offer to Tracy the next time I saw her. A terrible illness or a new baby. But there was nothing. 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 13. We stood on the balcony. Tracy held up a cigarette, stolen from my father, and I stood ready to light it for her. Before I could, she spat it from her mouth, kicked it behind her, and pointed down at my mother, who, as it turned out, was right below us on the communal lawn, smiling up. It was a mid-May Sunday morning, warm and bright. My mother was waving a dramatically large spade, like a Soviet farmer, and wearing a terrific outfit. Denim dungarees, thin, light brown crop top, perfect against her skin, Birkenstocks and a square yellow handkerchief folded into a triangle and worn over her head. This was tied at the back of her neck in a jaunty little knot. She was taking it upon herself, she explained, to dig up the communal grass, a rectangle about 8 foot by 3, with the idea of establishing a vegetable garden that everybody could enjoy. Tracy and I watched her. She dug for a while, pausing regularly to rest her foot on the lip of the shovel and to shout up to us about lettuces, the various strains, the right time for planting them, none of which interested us in the least, and yet everything she said was made somehow more compelling by that outfit. We watched as several other people came out of their flats to express concern or query her right to do what she was doing, but they were no match for her. And we noticed and admired the way she dispatched the fathers in a few minutes, essentially by looking into their eyes, while with the mothers she met with resistance. Yes, with the mothers she had to make a little more effort, drowning them in language until they understood how out of their depth they were, and the thin stream of their objections was completely subsumed by the quick-running currents of my mother's talk. Everything she said sounded so convincing, so impossible to contradict. It was a wave washing over you, unstoppable. Who didn't like roses? Who was so small-minded they would begrudge an inner-city child the chance to plant a seed? Weren't we all Africans originally?
Weren't we people of the land?
It started to rain. My mother, not dressed for rain, returned indoors. The next morning before school, we were excited to catch up with this spectacle. My mother, looking like Pam Grier herself, digging a large, illegal hole without permission from the council. But the spade lay exactly where she had left it, and the trench filled with water. The hole looked like somebody's half-dug grave. The next day it rained again, and no more digging was done. On the third day, a grey sludge began to rise up and spill into the grass.
"Clay," said my father, digging a finger into it. "She's got a problem now."
But he was wrong. It was his problem. Someone had told my mother that clay is only a layer of the earth, and if you dig deep enough you can get past it, and then all you have to do is go to the garden centre and get some compost and pour it into your large illegal hole. We peered down into the hole my father was now digging. Under the clay was more clay. My mother came downstairs and peered in, too, and claimed to be very excited about the clay. She never again mentioned vegetables, and if anyone else tried to mention them, she seamlessly adopted the new party line, which was that the hole had never been about lettuces, the hole had always been a search for clay, which had now been found. In fact, she had two potter's wheels just sitting upstairs. What a wonderful resource for the children. The wheels were small and very heavy. She had bought them because she liked the look of them, one freezing February when the lift doors malfunctioned. My father braced his knees, squared his arms, and lugged the bloody things up three flights of stairs. They were very basic, brutal in some way, a peasant's tool, and they had never been put to any use in our flat besides propping open the door to the living room. Now we would use them. We had to use them. If we didn't, my mother had dug a large hole in the communal gardens for no reason at all. Tracy and I were told to collect children. We managed to convince only three kids from the estate. To make up numbers, we added Lily Bingham. My father scooped clay into carrier bags and carted it up to the flat. My mother put a trestle table on the balcony and dropped a large lump of clay in front of each of us. It was a messy process. We probably would have been better off doing it in the bathroom or the kitchen, but the balcony allowed for an element of display. From up there, my mother's new concept in parenting could be seen by all. She was essentially asking the whole estate a question. What if we didn't plonk our children in front of the telly each day to watch the cartoons and the soap operas? What if we gave them, instead, a lump of clay and poured water over it and showed them how to spin it round until a shape formed between their hands? What kind of a society would that be? We watched the clay being spun between her palms. It looked like a penis, a long, brown penis, though it was only when Tracy whispered this idea into my ear that I allowed myself even to acknowledge the thought I was already having. "It's a vase," claimed my mother, and then added as clarification, "for a single flower." I was impressed. I looked around at the other children. Had their mothers ever thought to dig a vase out of the earth, or grow a single flower to be placed inside it? But Tracy was not taking it at all seriously. She was still beside herself at the idea of a clay penis. And now she set me off, and my mother frowned at us both, and turning her attention to Lily Bingham, asked her what she would like to make. A vase or a mug? Under her breath, Tracy suggested, again, the obscene third option. She was laughing at my mother. It was liberating. I had never imagined my mother could or should be a figure of fun, and yet Tracy found everything about her ridiculous. The way she spoke to us with respect, as if we were adults, giving us choices about things Tracy felt we had no business at all in choosing, and the license she gave us generally, allowing us to make all this unnecessary mess on her balcony, when everyone knew a real mother hated mess. And then having the cheek to call it arts, the cheek to call it crafts. When Tracy's turn came round and my mother asked her what she would like to make on the wheel, a vase or a mug, Tracy stopped laughing and scowled. "I see," said my mother. "Well, what would you like to make?" Tracy shrugged. "Doesn't have to be useful," my mother pressed.
Art means not having to be useful. In West Africa, for example, 100 years ago, there were some village women. They were making these strangely shaped pots, impractical pots, and the anthropologists couldn't understand what they were doing. But that was because they, the scientists, were expecting a quote-unquote primitive people to make only useful things, when actually they were making the pots just for their beauty, no different from a sculptor. Not to collect water, not to hold grain, just for their beauty. And to say, we were here, at this moment in time, and this is what we made. Well, you could do that, couldn't you? Yes, you could make something ornamental. That's your freedom, take it. Who knows, you might be the next Augusta Savage. I was used to my mother's speechifying. I tended to tune out whenever it was happening. And I was familiar, too, with the way she would drop whatever she happened to be studying that week into ordinary conversation. But I'm sure Tracy had never heard anything like it before in her life. She didn't know what an anthropologist was, or what a sculptor did, or who Augusta Savage was, or even what the word ornamental meant. She thought my mother was trying to make a fool of her. How could she know my mother found it impossible to speak in a natural way to children? 14. When Tracy got home each day after school, her flat was almost always empty. Who knew where her mother was? Down the high road, said my mother. This meant drinking. But I walked past the Sir Colin Campbell every day and never saw her in there. The times I did spot her, she was usually in the street bending someone's ear, often crying and dabbing at her eyes with a hanky, or else sitting at the bus stop on the other side of the estate wall, smoking, staring into space. Anything but sit in that tiny flat. And I didn't blame her. Tracy, by contrast, very much liked to be home. She never wanted to go to the playground or to be in the streets. She kept a key in her pencil case, let herself in, went straight to the sofa and began watching the Australian soaps until the British one started, a process which began at 4 p.m. and ended when the credits ran on Coronation Street. Somewhere in between, she either got her own tea or her mother arrived with takeaway and joined her on the sofa. I dreamt of freedom like hers. When I got home, either my mother or my father wanted to know what had happened at school today. They were very insistent about it. I wouldn't be let alone until I told them something, and so, naturally, I began lying to them. I thought of them at this point as two children, more innocent than me, whom it was my responsibility to protect from the kind of uncomfortable facts that they would either overthink, my mother, or overfeel, my father. That summer, the problem became acute because the true answer to, how was school today, was, there is a mania in the playground for grabbing vaginas. Three boys from Tracy's estate had initiated the game, but now everyone was playing. The Irish kids, the Greek kids, even Paul Barron, the completely Anglo-Saxon son of a policeman. It was like tag, but a girl was never it. Only boys were it. Girls simply ran and ran until we found ourselves cornered in some quiet spot, away from the eyes of dinner ladies and playground monitors, at which point our knickers were pulled aside and a little hand shot into our vaginas. We were roughly, frantically tickled, and then the boy ran away and the whole thing started up again from the top. You could tell the popularity of a girl by who got chased longest and hardest. Tracy, with her hysterical giggle and deliberately slow run, was, as usual, number one. I, wanting to be popular, also sometimes ran slowly, and the awkward truth is I wanted to be caught. I liked the electricity that ran from my vagina to my ear, even in anticipation of the hot little hand. But it is also true that when the hand actually appeared, some reflex in me, some ingrained concept of self-preservation inherited from my mother, always squeezed my legs together, and I tried to fight the hand, which was in the end always impossible. All I did was make myself even more unpopular by struggling for those first moments. As to whether you wanted one boy or another boy to chase you, no, this wasn't anybody's concern.
There was no hierarchy of desire, because desire was a very weak, practically non-existent element of the game. The important thing was that you were seen to be the kind of girl worth chasing. It was a game not of sex, but of status, of power. We did not desire or dread the boys in themselves. We only desired and dreaded being wanted or not being wanted. An exception to this was the boy with terrible eczema, whom we all truly and sincerely dreaded. Tracy as much as anyone, because he left, in your knickers, little flecks of dead grey skin. When our game mutated from playground prank to classroom risk, the boy with eczema became my daily nightmare. Now the game went like this. A boy dropped a pencil on the floor, always at a moment when Mr. Sherman had his back to us and his eyes on the board. The boy crawled under the table to retrieve the pencil, came up to a girl's crotch, pulled her knickers aside, and stuck his fingers in, leaving them there for as long as he thought he could get away with. The random element was now gone. Only the original three boys played, and they only visited those girls who were both close to their own desks, and whom they assumed would not complain. Tracy was one of these girls, as was I, and a girl from my corridor called Sasha Richards. The white girls, who had generally been included in the playground mania, were now mysteriously no longer included. It was as if they had never been involved in the first place. The boy with eczema sat one desk away from me. I hated those scaly fingers. I was horrified and disgusted by them, and yet, at the same time, could not help but take pleasure in that delightful and uncontrollable electricity rushing from my knickers to my ear. Of course, it wasn't possible to describe such things to my parents. In fact, this is the first time I have presented them in any way to anyone, even to myself. Strange now to think that we were all only 9 years old at the time. But I still look back on that period with a certain measure of gratitude for what I have come to see as my relative luck. It was the season of sex, yes, but it was also, in all the vital ways, without sex itself. And isn't that one useful definition of a happy girlhood? I didn't know or appreciate this aspect of my luck until well into adulthood, when I began to find, in more cases than I would have guessed, that among my women friends, irrespective of background, their own childhood sex seasons had been exploited and destroyed by the misdeeds of uncles and fathers, cousins, friends, strangers. I think of Amy, abused at 7, raped at 17. And beyond personal luck, there is geographical and historical luck. What happened to the girls on the plantations, or in the Victorian workhouses? The closest I came to anything like that was the music storeroom, and I did not come very close at all. And I have historical luck to thank for that, surely. But also Tracy, as it was she who came to my rescue in her own peculiar way. It was a Friday at the end of the day, not long before school broke up for the year, and I'd gone to the storeroom to borrow some sheet music. It was for the song We All Laughed, which Astaire sang so simply and so well, and I meant to give it to Mr. Booth on Saturday morning to help us sing it as a duet. Another piece of my luck was that Mr. Sherman, my class teacher, was also the school's music teacher, and as keen on the old songs as I was. He had a filing cabinet full of Gershwin scores and Porter scores and so on, kept here in the music cupboard, and on Fridays I was allowed to borrow what I wanted to be returned on Monday. The space was typical of such schools at the time, chaotic, too small, windowless, many ceiling tiles missing. Old violin and cello cases were stacked up against one wall, and there were plastic tubs of descant recorders full of saliva, their mouthpieces as chewed as dog toys. There were two pianos, one broken and covered in a dust sheet, one very out of tune, and many sets of African drums, for they were relatively cheap and anyone could play them. The overhead light didn't work. You had to work out what you wanted while the door was still open, pinpoint its location, and then, if the item was not in arm's reach, let the door shut and carry on in darkness. Mr. Sherman had told me he'd left the folder I needed on top of the grey filing cabinet in the far left-hand corner, and I spotted the cabinet and let the door ease shut. The darkness was complete. I had the folder in my hand and my back to the door. A thin streak of light sliced the room for a few moments and disappeared. I turned. I felt hands on me. One pair of hands I recognized immediately. The boy with eczema. The other, I soon understood, belonged to this boy's best friend, a lanky, uncoordinated child called Jordan, who was mentally slow, easily led, and sometimes dangerously impulsive, a set of symptoms which had, back then, no particular diagnosis, or none that Jordan and his mother were ever given. Jordan was in my class, but I never called him Jordan. I called him Spaz. Everybody did. But if it was meant as an insult, he had long ago diffused it by answering to it cheerfully as if it were his name. His status in our class was peculiar. Despite his condition, whatever it was, he was tall and handsome. While we looked like children, he looked like an adolescent. His arms had muscle in them and his hair was sharp, shaved on the sides in a real barber's shop. He was no good at classwork, had no real friends, but he was a useful and passive sidekick for boys with nefarious plans, and was more often than not the focus of the teacher's attention. The smallest interruption from him had a disproportionate effect, and this was interesting for the rest of us. Tracy did tell a teacher to fuck off without even being sent to stand in the hall, but Jordan passed most of his time in that hall, for what seemed, to the rest of us, small infractions, talking back or not removing a baseball cap. And after a while of this, we began to understand that the teachers, especially the white women, were scared of him. We respected that. It seemed like a special thing, an achievement, to make a grown woman fear you, though you were only 9 years old and mentally disabled. Personally, I was on good terms with him. He had sometimes put his fingers in my knickers, but I was never convinced he knew why he was doing it. And on the walk home, if we happened to fall in step, I sometimes sang for him, the theme tune to Top Cat, a cartoon with which he was obsessed. And this soothed and made him happy. He would walk along, head inclined towards me, making a low, gurgling sound like a contented baby. I did not think of him as an aggressor. Yet here he was, in the music cupboard, touching me everywhere, giggling in a manic way, following and imitating the more calculated laugh of the boy with eczema. And it was clear that this wasn't the playground game or the classroom game. It was a new and perhaps dangerous escalation. The boy with eczema was laughing, and I was meant to laugh. Everything was meant to be a kind of joke. But each time I tried to keep some item of clothing up, they pulled it down, and I was meant to laugh at that, too. Then the laughing stopped, and something urgent took over. They worked in silence, and I went silent myself. At that moment, the thin streak of light reappeared. Tracy was at the door. I saw her in silhouette, framed in the light. She closed the door behind her. She didn't say anything right away. She just stood with us in the dark, silent, not doing anything. The boy's hand slowed down. It was the child's version of sexual absurdity, familiar to adults, when something that appeared so urgent and all-consuming a moment before now suddenly seems, often in conjunction with the light going on, small and pointless, even tragic. I looked over at Tracy, still burnt into my retina in relief form. I saw her outline, the retroussé nose, the perfectly divided plaits with their satin bows. At last she took a step back, opened the door wide, and held it open. "Paul Barron's waiting for you at the gate," she said. I stared at her, and she said it again, this time irritably, like I was wasting her time. I pulled down my skirt and hurried past. We both knew it was not possible that Paul Barron was waiting for me at the gate. His mother picked him up every day in a Volkswagen. His dad was a policeman. He had a permanently trembling upper lip and big, wet blue eyes like a puppy. I had not spoken two words to Paul Barron my whole life. Tracy claimed he'd put his fingers in her knickers, but I had seen him play that game and noticed that he ran around the playground without aim, looking for a tree to hide behind. I strongly suspected him of not wanting to catch anybody. But his was the right name at the right moment. I could be messed with as long as I was considered a part of that element in the school, which expected and deserved no better, but Paul Barron was a part of the other world. He couldn't be messed with. And this fictional connection with him, even for a moment, formed some kind of protection.
I ran down the hill to the gate and found my father waiting for me there. We got ice creams from the van and walked home together. At the traffic lights, I heard a lot of noise and looked across and saw Tracy and the boy with eczema and the one we called Spaz laughing and fighting and messing with each other, swearing freely and seeming to enjoy the public.